Welcome, everyone. Thank you for hosting us, Nashua Public Library, and thanks to the wider Nashua community for being here. As we examine how the Nashua area has experienced the addiction and drug crisis, we have four people with deep and direct knowledge of this issue. With us tonight are Bobby Bagley, Director of Nashua's Division of Public Health and Community Services. And Bobby, a big thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Ellen.
Also with us...
Laura. Ellen, where did Ellen come from?
Ellen booked the guests, so
Ellen,
it's okay.
Oh,
Melbourne Moran is also here. He's Director of Integrated Care and Population Health at Harbor Homes, which provides an array of social services. He also oversees a mobile crisis response team where he is the clinical director. And Mel, really nice to meet you. Thank you also for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Jessica Parnell. She's Program Director and Community Recovery Coach for the Revive Recovery Center in Nashua. She's the state's first publicly funded recovery coach. And Jess, thank you so much. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you.
And also with us, Brian Rhodes, Chief of Nashua's Fire Rescue Division, which includes the city's Safe Station, a gateway to recovery. And Chief Rhodes, really good to have you too. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and welcome to the Gate City.
Well, and a broad question for all of you, and then we'll definitely get specific. But first, just overall, how would you say this opioid crisis has affected your community here in Nashua? Where do you in particular see it? And Bobby, I'm going to go to you first, please.
This crisis has affected our city in a broad way, to the point where we've been able to mobilize many of our community partners, because I don't think that there's anyone that hasn't been touched by this opioid crisis, whether it's a family member, a colleague, a friend. We've been impacted in a mighty way here in Nashua, but we've also, along with that, been able to respond in a great way as well.
What are you seeing sort of on the ground? Do you see it in the schools? Do you see it in the healthcare system? Do you see it in terms of city services? Give us a couple sort of specifics in terms of your daily life, Bobby.
Yeah, so as at the health department, as a director there, working with our staff that works on the prevention piece of this, we see it across the board. So people that are impacted by substance use disorder, you're going to see them in the hospitals. You're going to see them in the community. And because of that, you know, the again, like I said, the response that we have has to come from all sectors. And so our medical providers, as we have here this evening, our fire and first responders, community service organizations, recovery organizations, we're all responding because each of our organizations and in our communities were touched by this in a great way.
Chief Rhodes, what do you see?
Well, I see a community that our first responders have been dealing with this for years. And our first responders are regular people, just like you and I. Our first responders have had, we've had members of my organization who have lost family members to this horrible disease. Our police department, our ambulance service, our fire and rescue members, we're seeing this every day, and it was really starting to take a toll because there seemed like there was no end in sight. This was a revolving, it was just a cycle that was happening. The inception of the, and you know, and I guess we have to first, we're talking about the Safe Station program and a lot of this, we have to give our props to Chris Hickey in Manchester for thinking outside the box. And we kind of took upon what they had as a program, and we think we built even a better box in the city. And I think I can't speak for the police department or AMR, but I know my staff, they see people in a different light now. And they're actually seeing people coming in who want help, instead of us going when we were requested for help. They have seen, our first responders have seen some horrible sights, things that people in this room can't imagine. And it was starting to really wear on them. So this city, the way it stepped up and it got everyone together, from public health to hospitals to the recovery community, to the mayor's office, to the hospitals, to the police department, fire, ambulance. It's a testament to this city and the people in this city that enough was enough and we had to do something.
Well, what you're saying reminds me of Bobby and I were talking before the program, and I said, wow, this is so big and it's so hard and it's so sad. And she said, yes, but there's a lot of hope. And there's a lot of good things going on here in Nashua, so we'll definitely talk about that. I wonder what you see day-to-day, Mel. Again, you work for an organization that provides a variety of social services, including a mobile crisis unit. So I just wonder what you're seeing.
First, I would start off by saying that what drew me to Nashua, I live here with my wife and kids, but I grew up surrounded by addiction and mental illness in my family, my friends. What drew me here was the Safe Station program to come work in Nashua with the Mobile Crisis Response Team. At that time, it wasn't part of the model, but the Harbor Homes jumping in and being a community leader with the fire department, the mayor's office, and public health and Revive really drew me to stop being a provider in Massachusetts and start providing the services I can here in Nashua. And what I see every day is a program like the Safe Station program and the Mobile Crisis Response Team that could have saved the lives of family members that I lost or friends that I've lost to addiction and mental illness. As a provider here, I've had to administer Narcan going to social work school. Never thought I'd be having to put Narcan up someone's nose to revive them. It's something that I have to give diligence to the police and the fire and the EMS to do this every day, to have to bring someone back after they overdosed, even after getting to our facility for treatment. So we see people that are coming in for recovery, actively seeking in that pre-contemplation phase where maybe their family has convinced them to show up to the chief's fire station for care. And it's our job at Mobile Crisis to keep those people motivated and engaged with the services that we offer and get them on to the next stage of recovery in their lives.
Well, and we'll definitely spend some time, defining these terms. I mean, a lot of people here know what they are, but we'll talk about, what is a mobile crisis unit? What is a safe station? What is a recovery coach for sure? These are becoming terms that people are starting to get used to hearing here in New Hampshire, but we should spend a little time about what they mean and how they're playing out here in Nashua. Jess, I don't want to forget you. Again, this opioid crisis has affected you personally. You're a recovery coach. You've got your own experiences. And I just wonder what you can share in terms of what this community or yourself has experienced in terms of opioids.
Thank you. From our perspective at Revive, the opioid epidemic is affecting people in all sectors. It's our friends, it's our family members, it's our children, it's our loved ones. And the Nashua community the recovery community in Nashua is strong. About a year ago, Mayor Donches in the city of Nashua decided that Nashua needs more recovery coaches. And that's what brought me to Revive. Over the past year, we've grown in numbers drastically. When I first started at Revive, maybe 5 to 10 people would come through the door every day. Now we're seeing upwards of 100 people in our recovery center. We're a recovery community center, so we're open to the public. We offer recovery coaching services, telephone recovery support for those that might find it harder to get into the center. It's great to work for an organization and work in a city where everyone's taken a stand and said, this is enough. We need to make a change.
What myths or misconceptions, I'll start with you, Jess, do you think some people may have about this problem?
There's many myths. Some people have a better understanding of being addicted to opioids or any kind of drug or substance. And oftentimes, we don't realize how close to home it is. People have family members that they don't want to talk to other people about because of stigma. This is a problem that if we want to fix it, we need to acknowledge it and take a step in the right direction.
What do you think, Bobby? Myths, misconceptions?
Some of the myths and misconceptions that we deal with are around the fact that people can do this on their own. This is a disease. And when we acknowledge substance use disorder as a disease, it helps us to respond to individuals that are living and families that are impacted by substance use disorder in a way that's more compassionate, that's more kind.
And less judgy.
And less judgmental. It takes all of us to understand that the human part of this, the connection, helps so much in recovery. You know, it's that hope that individuals experience when they're not judged by this disease that's impacting them the way that it is. I myself have lived with a family member who had addiction, substance use disorder for over 10 years. And initially, until I learned more about how this disease was impacting my own family, my thing was just stop. You can just stop this. And with substance use disorder, with addiction, there are changes that go on in the brain that makes it so individuals, they need more than just an attitude of just stop. They need compassion. They need us to understand that it's going to take more than just that judgmental position of, you know, this is something that's all just in your head, and you started it, it's your fault.
I wonder what you think about that, Jess.
Yes.
Can you relate to that?
Very much so. Trying to build the recovery community here in Nashua, you know, we're faced with many people coming through the doors that have, you know, reached out to get help, and sometimes there's misconceptions around it, and, you know, they take that step back because of it, and, you know, they're afraid that they're going to be misunderstood. And we're doing what we can in this area to, you know, make providers and family members aware and
that it's addiction and mm-hmm. something's going on in the brain, and it isn't just as easy as saying, okay, I'm going to stop today.
Right.
Yeah. What do you think, Mel?
I think it takes a village. A little feedback. It takes a village to really come together and help a community heal. And what we're seeing with the opioid epidemic is the city of Nashua, led by Mayor Donches, and the public health department really come together with the fire department and community partners to really address an issue of such loss of words, such gravitas, that it really takes us all working together to show that those people coming for help don't have to do it alone.
When you are in the mobile crisis unit, you're going out helping people who are in crisis, obviously, and I've heard stories from police and fire that sometimes they're reviving the same person 4, 5, 6 times. How do you avoid not getting frustrated with that person and saying, kind of like Bobby said, okay, could you just stop?
It's all about self-care and compassion and fatigue. The mobile crisis team consists of certified recovery support workers, certified peer support workers, and therapists. All of us are trained to identify when that compassion fatigue hits us. We see the same person over and over again, but we remember through our training and through the continuing education that we do that it may not be the first time that someone comes in that they're going to sustain sobriety. It may be the 28th time. It may be the 50th time.
Wow.
I've had people come through Safe Station over 100 times, and that 101th time might be that magic moment where they've actually will be able to sustain sobriety.
Yeah. Is that the time?
Yes.
So you keep plugging away.
Yes, keep plugging away.
You know, we have a big audience here in Nashua, and I do want to go to some of our audience members. So let's invite you into our conversation. We've got some input that we received from listeners before tonight's event, and I want to welcome you to the microphone and welcome you to our event here in Nashua.
Hi, I'm John Cannon from New London, and I'm a longtime first responder in the fire and EMS community over 40 years, and so I've seen firsthand the toll that opioids have taken on the families and the communities. And I think today we have a lot of state and community leaders seem to kind of patting themselves on the back, and we're kind of feeling positive about the trends and the reduction in deaths. But I think the real measure is what are the rates of actual overdoses. We've got more and more Narcan out there. More and more people are trained to provide Narcan, and it's readily available. So I think we are saving a lot of lives, but are we actually reducing the number of incidents? And I think there's some news that actually that they are noticing a decline, but now the shift is going back to meth and other drugs. So, and then just as a kind of a strong recommendation for the big picture, as well as a comprehensive and thorough look at the opioid crisis, the history, the economic, political, legal factors, is the book Dreamland by Sam Quinones. It's a really very good read and just thoroughly addresses the whole thing, where it comes from in Mexico and how cities were taken over and Rust Belt communities died and everything. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And we should talk about, you know, the numbers. And I'll go to you first, Chief Rhodes. You know, we hear, oh, the number of overdose deaths is going down. That's good. And it is good, of course. But what doesn't that number tell us? I know you've got some new numbers too, Bobby. So I'll fold you in too. But go ahead, Chief.
I don't think there's one answer. There are many things that are contributing to that. I think it's the...
The overdose deaths going down.
Yes, yeah. I think it's the awareness in the community is getting better. I think it's the availability of Narcan. I think it's the availability of innovative ideas like the governor's hub and spoke, like Safe Station, that get people into that initial phase of the recovery when they're ready. I think our friends in the police department are doing an incredible job, but I think it's an uphill battle, because I look at these people, and I've spoken with a lot of loved ones who have come into the fire station, and these drug dealers are predators. And the police department takes 5 off the street, 10 more pop up. And I think the introduction of fentanyl into our society, the laboratory made, is a game changer.
Yeah, and not a good game changer.
Not a good game changer, yeah. No.
Very deadly.
I don't think there's, you know, in the city of Nashville, we have the needle exchange, we have the recovery coaches, we have... the Safe Station. We have a lot of things that are working here, and I think, to the gentleman from New London's point, we are fortunate as a community that we have what we have for resources in our community, and a lot of communities just don't have that. That's the reality of it. But I think we are, as a community, we are taking advantage of everything we have, and I've said this from the beginning, and it may get old for some people, but I begin my 33rd year with the city in March. This is the greatest collaboration I have ever seen in my time here. Silos have been broken down, relationships have been made, and that's how we get ahead of this problem.
As Bobby said earlier, Bobby, I know you've got some new numbers here in Nashua on, as you said, overdose deaths, overdoses in general, what that means, what it tells us, what it doesn't. So go ahead, please.
So we actually have seen a decrease in overdose deaths over the past few years. We're down 18% here in Nashua and down 18% in Manchester as well. Nashua and Manchester are two largest cities, and we have folks that come from all over the state, folks that are coming from out of state, you know, here to go through our Safe Stations programs in both of our cities. 18% is significant as far as a reduction rate in what we're seeing with the deaths. And as the chief said, it's because of the collaborative effort and all of the different interventions that have been put in place. We have to stay vigilant, though. Substance use disorder is not new. Using heroin is not new, although what we have seen is deaths related to heroin overdose are down really, really low, and it is the fentanyl that's causing the majority of the deaths. In fact, like 98% of the deaths that we've seen in our state. As the chief said, I mean, with police, the vigilance, the granite hammer, getting fentanyl off the streets is really, really important. The Narcan distribution has been very helpful in reducing those deaths. Our overdoses, they kind of go up and down, but even that's down as well. And so the work that's been done as a collaborative in response to this has had a significant impact on what we're seeing, and we have got to remain vigilant. One of the other pieces that I would add to that is that we've got to increase our resources for prevention efforts. So we've got a lot of money that's come in, right, to address treatment, to address recovery, which we need every single dollar. So I wouldn't say decrease any of that. But we also want to make sure that we increase resources for prevention efforts, because we need to get ahead of it, right? We need to start to address some of the root causes of substance use disorder. We need to look at mental health issues. But it is very important that those numbers continue to go down. Nashua, in January, we had zero reports of death fatalities as a result of overdoses, right? And that's good. So we need to continue our efforts to make sure that we continue to see a decrease in those numbers.
You want to jump in, Matt?
Yeah, just to add to that, for sure here in the healthcare industry in Nashua, Harbor Homes, Keystone, Greater Nashua Mental Health Center have geared towards a harm reduction model of care versus an abstinence-only model. We've started to understand as providers that relapse is part of recovery, where in previous models, abstinence-only programs would kick you out of the program if you relapsed. Now we have models set up that if someone does relapse, we're there to support and guide them back into recovery, to either re-enter into a detox if needed, or into residential or outpatient care.
So opening up models of treatment.
Yeah, expanding the thought process of how clinicians see addiction.
I have to ask about fentanyl, since you mentioned it, and certainly I've heard that from other communities as well, that fentanyl is really what is doing in so many people. And I've heard from people, I'm going to ask you this, Jess, you know, sometimes when I talk about this issue, people I meet around the community afterwards will say, well, everybody knows fentanyl is so dangerous and horrible. Why would someone take fentanyl?
To numb the pain.
For many, they know it's incredibly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, for many different reasons. You know, looking into the root causes of addiction, you're looking at, you know, mental health issues. You're looking at family issues. From as a woman in long-term recovery. There was, you know, once a time when I would look to get the most dangerous drug out there. You know, I hear that someone overdoses, and it sounds, you know, crazy, but I want to find out where that guy got it, because it's going to get you high. You know, you reach a point where you don't care if you're living anymore. And that's somewhere that I'm very thankful I'm not at right now, and I don't have to go there ever again.
So maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago, it would be alcohol. Now it's fentanyl, and yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's something really deep, deep going on there that would make you make that choice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for the rest of us, you know, who haven't gone through what you've gone through, to say, how could you go there? But you just explained it really well. Do you want to jump in too, Mel? Because you deal with people all the time who are overdosing or in crisis and so forth.
You'd be surprised at the amount of people that come through who have post-traumatic stress disorder, homeless, suicidal ideations, homicidal ideations because of the substances that you're using, and going to use substances to dull the pain, as Jess said, to deal with that underlying mental health issue. The amount of clients that we have seen with childhood trauma, unresolved grief, very explicit trauma, and then shifting to self-medication through opiates and other drugs is drastic, and it's part of this behavioral health piece of integrated care that we work towards at Harbor Homes to address a multitude of illnesses.
Let's go back to our audience again. Lots of people with questions. And good evening. Thank you for being here. And go ahead, please. Give us your name and where you're from. And go ahead.
I'm Sue Barber. I'm from Nashua. My question actually kind of ties into what you were talking about in the mental health issues. My daughter isn't a recovering addict. and she actually got addicted through her mental health care medication that she was given for her problems. And one of the things we ran into is that she would go to a doctor and then they would move on. So then you're finding another doctor and you've got to find somebody who fits. And in the meantime, they're getting prescriptions from doctors who aren't really following their care. And she was really good at talking herself into prescriptions. So, like, you know, every time she came out of the doctor's office, she had another prescription. But then the other side of that is, because it is mental health, as a parent, you're not allowed in there. So you don't know what's, that they're doling out the prescription. And I shouldn't say that, I'm not trying to bash doctors, but I'm, like, my question was about, like, how are you attacking this from every angle?
I'm so glad you asked that question, and you're right. Once they're 18, they're considered adults, and you maybe aren't allowed in the room. And we should talk about the mental health piece of this a little bit more. And Bobby, I'll turn to you. A lot of people have in mental health have said, you know, this was a crisis waiting to happen. We've had a broken mental health system here in New Hampshire, and this is the result. And I think some of you have addressed that already, but I wonder what you think about Sue's comments.
With regards to individuals seeking prescription medication, as it was said already, so if you think about it this way, individuals who have substance use disorder, when they're using their substance of choice, it's not that folks are looking to try an overdose. As Jess said, it's about dulling the pain. And if, and Mel, you know, can speak more to, you know, from the mental health side of it, but when you think about people trying to self-medicate, you know, to take care of what's going on in here, you know, in their brains, in here, in their hearts, and they have been exposed to a means of being able to do that through prescription drugs, and then that prescription drug is taken away from them, they've got to find some other way of replacing that substance so that they can take care of themselves. And so that self-medication piece is going to come in there. And so we talked about this being a disease where the whole brain chemistry changes. Think about this. Everybody likes chocolate, right? When you eat chocolate, how do you feel? For those that like chocolate, you feel good. And you go back and you eat chocolate again because it makes you feel a certain way. I like the way Lisa, who's our substance misuse prevention coordinator, talks about substance use disorder and how people get to the place of, you know, of addiction. When there are things that make you feel good in your brain and release those chemicals in your brain that make you feel good, you're going to go back to that over and over and over again. And so when people are looking at ways of getting substances that they need to make them feel good, they're going to do it in any kind of way that they can. And they're going to find out different ways of getting different prescriptions because they're trying to take care of themselves. Mel, do you want to add more to that?
I would kind of take a bit of what the chief said. Here in Nashua, we've really broken down a lot of silos in treatment. We are talking to each other. We are engaged with each other. We're talking about medical care, mental health care, substance use care, even oral hygiene care. But our state, and I don't know if there's any state reps or senators in the room, has to understand that when it comes to mental health and substance use disorder, it's behavioral health. There's these two siloed agencies, the Bureau of Drug and Alcohol and the Bureau of Mental Health. I don't really think they talk to each other that much. And then you have systems break down, and it impacts the residents of the state. We have to hold our leaders in office accountable to ensure that our systems of care that are responsible for taking care of the people of the state are communicating, talking, and sharing information with each other, and understanding that just because I work for this department doesn't mean that someone who's getting care from this department does not also have a mental illness. And we really need to break down those silos at the state.
Well, and it's exciting, and the good news is to hear about all the great things that are going on here in Nashua, silos being broken down. You all have talked about, you know, with some enthusiasm and some hope about the efforts being made in this city. So that's good to hear. Mm-hmm. I want to ask all of you, and maybe you first, Chief Rhodes, about the new hub and spoke system that's being put in place. There's a lot of interest in this. It's being rolled out. There's a lot of federal money behind this. I just wonder, all of you, but Chief Rhodes, you first, where do you think this money should go? How you think this hub and spoke system is going to play out here in Nashua?
Very hopeful that it enhances the program that we currently have. Very hopeful and optimistic that it is going to offer more resources for us to use. Very hopeful that it takes some pressure off of my personnel so that when someone does feel they have that they're ready, they can go right to step one and kind of bypass the fire station. I think it remains to be seen.
And it's still new, and it's still being put in place.
Right.
I would like to hear from you too, Mel, on this, and Jess and Bobby. Go ahead, Mel.
Right. First, I'm just going to cover up Harbor Homes here, because it's probably not the most political thing to say for my employer. But I would say, first, yes, in concept, in theory, the hub-and-spoke model is a good concept in theory. But the way it's been set up in this state is essentially epistemic social injustice, where you have external forces, the government, the institutions, expressing a belief system on our clients that we serve through financial incentives. Someone comes to the hub, you'll get an extra benefit for going to the hub, and if a spoke takes you, they're going to get an extra financial benefit for taking you from the hub. What happens to the client that comes in and walks into my practice and says, I would like care? Am I going to take someone who is going to get an extra $100 a day for providing you care because you came from the hub? Or am I going to take someone else where I'm not going to get that extra $100? We have to take that financial aspect of care, and this directly impacts people of a lower social economic standing. This is the social worker in me speaking. People who are homeless and have Medicaid or are uninsured or underinsured need to be able to access care without barriers like these continuous assessments that they need to go over, called a GIPRA, to report data back into the state. I have Harvard Pilgrim. I can go anywhere I want, and they're not going to ask me a ton of questions to get care. And there needs to be parity between private health care and Medicaid.
So some concerns about the system being bureaucratic,
yes,
and also being expensive for people who might be homeless.
Not even expensive.
Or low income.
Just treated differently.
Yeah.
You have to go here if you want to get care.
Jess, all of you talked earlier about a lot of great stuff going on here in Nashua to tackle this crisis. I wonder how you feel about some of the newer systems that are being put in place, and maybe where you fit in as a recovery coach.
Okay. I think, you know, this new model and the new programs that are starting up in this area are just a way to reinforce what's already been done. You know, the Safe Station program is about 3 years old now, and, you know, we've recently just got a good handle on it, and I think we're working together as a community really well. So I'm hoping that, you know, this extra funding and extra support will just enhance what's already happening. As a recovery coach, you know, I'm seeing people when they're reaching out to get treatment for the first time, and having that the tool of the Safe Station program and mobile crisis is great, because it's an instant response. So as someone in recovery and having family members who have also struggled with this disease, I know that when someone wants to get treatment and they're saying they want treatment, it needs to happen right away.
Can't make someone wait.
Exactly. And, you know, giving them a couple more minutes to think about it could change their mind. So I'm seeing people, you know, who are looking to get treatment, who, you know, are following those people to the treatment centers, doing outreach at Keystone Hall, at Farnham Center. And then, you know, we're keeping in contact with them while they're there. And then once they get out, they're getting in touch and engaging in recovery coaching to keep that long-term recovery.
Go ahead, Bobby. And then we'll go back to our audience.
Yes, I'm actually seeing the the doorway, the hub and spoke model, as something that will enhance what we're already doing here in Nashua. So, you know, we know that we've made some great strides with our Safe Stations program, and the access point that comes through that, and the hub and spoke will open up even more access points with some of the additional resources that Mel mentioned. And they've already started to receive referrals. They've been in existence now. It's been at least 1 month. They're partnering with the agencies that are here and making sure that collaboration, that transparency, the extra things that we needed will come through these extra resources that are going to come through this hub and spoke model. So
feeling hopeful.
I'm hopeful.
Like yeah. The chief. Real quick, Mel, and then we'll go back to our audience.
The one thing I have to say is that Granite Pathways came to Nashua and saw what was going on, and they did add value. I'm speaking about the hub and spoke throughout the state. The Granite Pathways team, exceptional.
Let's go back to members of our audience, and go ahead. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Irina Owens from Brookline, New Hampshire. So with all of the great advances that the city of Nashua and the state of New Hampshire has made in prevention, treatment, and recovery for substance use disorder, there still seems to be a large majority of people struggling with what they can personally do to help their friends and loved ones. Phrases such as, you can't do it for them, they have to really want it, and they need to hit rock bottom, in my opinion, leads people to disconnect from their friends and loved ones and struggle with ways to support them. So my question is, since this is a public health crisis of epidemic proportion, are there any large-scale public messaging campaigns being developed that will specifically target the public on what they themselves can do to help their friends and loved ones move forward into recovery? And if not, why?
So how can the community, the family of someone who's struggling also be brought into that process? Yeah, Jess.
So we at Revive, we do have some family support groups. We have a handful of them, some led by clinicians that help, you know, explain the science of addiction, why our family members are the way they are, and how to help them best, give you some tools. And we also have other support groups for families as well.
I like the way, Irina, you described it as the soil that someone comes from. Can you tell us, Jess, about your own family, your own friends, your own community, and how they tried to help, how they were just working through this with you, or not working through it? Maybe it was too difficult.
So for me personally, I did not begin my recovery journey here in Nashua, but I can speak to having a loved one who I personally brought to a safe station. And, you know, I had that warm handoff with the fire team where, you know, he was taken in, treated great, you know, had an assessment right then. You know, he was connected with resources and is still in recovery today.
I love your thoughts too, Bobby, on just sort of nurturing the soil that is trying to support the person who's struggling with addiction.
I think the key to that, again, is that compassion and that support of never giving up. It does get hard. It is tough because it's complex. Sometimes there's anger that's mixed in there with disappointment because of the repeated components of this. I think in addressing a major, you know, public health campaign on messaging around this, we're working to get as much information and create as much awareness about substance use disorder as a disease as possible to help people understand better how they want to respond to their loved ones, and understanding why we're putting so much into this. It's not a moral failing. It's a disease that we're dealing with. And just as we would want to support others in their recovery of other diseases, we want to take that same type of positioning with individuals that are dealing with substance use disorder. So some of the campaigning and then the messaging that we're getting out and that we push out through our Facebook, through our newsletters, through some of the awareness and education and the teachings that we're doing, focus around just that point of, you know, the reducing the stigma and recognizing this as a disease and how we need to respond as a community to this disease.
talking about the frustration and family members, and it's so hard when you're trying to be supportive, but the person keeps relapsing. You talked about seeing people, you know, overdose many, 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 many times. How much do you think, Mel, relapse is part of the recovery process? It's hard for loved ones to know that.
It's hard to explain it. I've seen personal family members have 15 years of sobriety and then relapse through an abstinence model. Now they're trying Vivitrol, an injection that helps reduce the cravings of alcohol. But it, from a family perspective, to see the cycle over and over again, it's hard to disconnect and say, here's some evidence-based research that says that it's part of the addiction. You're too emotionally connected to that person. The only advice I could give to the family member is just be there, be present, and be willing to engage with that person who's seeking recovery and reconnect with them when you're ready and mend some burnt bridges. Mend some fences and rebuild some burnt bridges.
It must be hard not to be just angry, though, with this person.
It's personal, yes. you get, even as a social worker, being trained, you get extremely angry at the loved ones that you see get on the wagon, for lack of a better word, and then just one bad decision leads to a binge of 6 weeks, and you know, how would you do that after such a great period of time doing so well for you and your family?
I want to ask all of you, maybe start with you, Jess, about the role of medication-assisted treatment. This is being used more and more. The federal grants that came into New Hampshire recently focus on medication-assisted treatment. Could you talk about how that is used in the recovery process, either the people you work with or your own process, Jess?
Sure. And maybe, Mel, you could probably speak to the more of the medical side of that. I can speak on my own experience. Medically assisted treatment is, you know, Suboxone, methadone, Vivitrol, and these are medications that are used to get people off of using illegal drugs. And, you know, from my experience, I have used medically some forms of MAT when in the early phases of recovery. You know, Mel talked about a harm reduction model here in this area. And, you know, when we're using medically assisted treatments and medications, we are reducing the harm of that the drugs are having on our community. People, you know, can use these drugs or these medications so they're not using illegal drugs.
So it helps reduce the terrible feelings that you have when you mm-hmm. go off the opioid, and that not feeling terrible helps you go to, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, other types of therapies, and mm-hmm. so forth. That's how it works. So, mm-hmm. And how do you, I guess I'll turn to you maybe, Bobby, how do you feel about the grants that are coming in now being focused, not exclusively, but heavily on medication-assisted treatment?
As part of an intervention in response to what we're seeing, I think it's important that MAT, or medically assisted treatment, is available. An individual that may you know, be treated in the hospital, in the emergency room, if they can leave with something that will help prevent them from overdosing, because they leave and they need something, you know, to help them, again, not feel that pain or not feel uncomfortable going through withdrawals. This is a really important public health intervention that's helpful and evidence-based that shows that this works in helping a person get to the next steps of where they need to be, to that next level of care that's needed.
Let's go back to our audience and lots of people with questions. Go ahead. Thank you for being here. Give us your name and where you're from. Thanks.
I'm Elizabeth Caswell from Nashua. I'm a New Hampshire educator, and I'm constantly worried about how this opioid epidemic is going to impact the next generation. And with that, I have a few questions, if you don't mind. Have there been any studies that are tracking the impacts that the epidemic is having on the under 18 population, and have you seen an increase in use or a decrease in use within those population, that population as well? And I know that you've been talking a lot about recovery response, and not so much about what's set in place for prevention. So do you have anything in place other than classes, health classes, things for students to prevent them from going down that road? Thank you.
Well, really important, young people, prevention, and boy, we could talk about that for hours, so thank you very much. I'm going to turn to you first, Chief, actually, on your thoughts. I know you're sort of more front lines, but you've also been watching this for a while. What do you think about what really seems to work with prevention, whether enough efforts are being made with young people?
Honestly, I don't think there's enough being done with young people. And I am not by any means trying to discount young adults who are suffering with addiction. I think if you look at today's society, and we are an instant gratification society, everything is on a smartphone, kids know everything. I think we are behind the curve. If we're worrying about children in junior high school and high school, that horse has left the barn.
So start really early.
We need to get into the third, fourth, fifth grades and start teaching our young children about the effects of this. It's kind of frustrating. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's very frustrating when we look at as great as this grant is, because it's needed. We have a huge problem in our state, in our country, with alcoholism. And unfortunately, this grant is laser-focused on opioids. And a lot of it goes hand in hand. As Mel said and Bobby said, and just, you know, everybody knows, there are co-occurring things that are happening here. There's mental illness, there's alcoholism, there's opioid addiction, and you know, we're throwing a lot of resources at the opioids now, but we see a lot of people come into the fire station who are struggling with alcoholism, and it's somewhat frustrating.
Yeah, we've done programs on let's not forget alcohol addiction, because that is still a big problem in this state. I'm just curious, Chief, how young, as we talk about young people, and thank you again for the question, how young are some of the people that come into Safe Station?
To date, we have not had anyone under the legal age of 18 who have come in. But knowing that, I can't even imagine what it's like to be an educator now and try to deal with kids in school, because this problem, and by no means am I an expert.
Well, you've seen a lot.
I've learned a lot in 2.5 years. But what I do know from people coming in, this problem doesn't affect one person. It's probably 10 or 20 people behind that one person that this problem is affecting. And that goes from spouses, parents, children. I've had parents come in. A mother in her 70s was taking care of her son in his 50s. We've had a grandmother come in with her daughter and her granddaughter. And unfortunately, when I go back to when I said earlier that a lot of the first responders, the police, fire, and EMS, see things that people in this room can't believe, I'm not trying for shock value here, but we would go into homes and there would be people who would be on death's doorstep there, and there'd be young children in the room watching TV. And that really affects us, because we have kids, we have grandkids, we have our regular, you know, we're human beings too. It's tough. It's really tough. But I think programs like this and the work that hopefully the hub and spoke and what we've done are going to enhance the programs in the state, are going to give some hope to our people who are struggling with addiction, who are going to give hope to our healthcare professionals, who are going to give hope to the recovery community. But we have to break that perception in the community. I'll never forget, Mayor Donchus, after he got elected, he went out and did he did his 9 ward meetings, and I probably made 6 of them, and our half and the chief at the time did the other half. And what you would think for a ward meeting coming up would be about potholes and stop signs and schools
was snow plowing,
safe station program. And we had tried to do a lot as a city, a lot of advertising, a lot of messaging to get that out there. And still at that point, there was a lot of unknowns that people just don't understand it. They don't understand it. As Bobby said, there's a lot of people out there today that still think, well, why don't they just stop?
Why don't they stop? Like Bobby said earlier, yeah.
This is a personal choice they made. No, it's not. I've heard Lieutenant Kinney, who's in the audience tonight from Nashville Police, does a great job with the Narcotics Division, say, people don't wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to rob a bank today. People don't wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to become addicted to opioids. This a lot of this isn't personal choice. A lot of this is stuff that happens to them, and they are brought to that, having to make those choices.
What about prevention, Bobby? Do we do enough?
We can do more. I mean, we can always do more. The question about, you know, what's available for our youth, we have identified that there is a serious gap with resources for our youth. For instance, at safe stations, we can take folks that are 18, and over. We can transport folks that are 18 and over, to Harbor Homes for some of the care services, but we can't take the minors. And so we do need to have programs in place where youth can go, not just in Nashville. This is around, our whole state, where those resources for youth is very low. We want to make sure that with prevention, again, that we focus on kids as young as we can, because they do know a lot. We did an event outside the Boys and Girls Club, and we had our drug board there. And our drug board has pictures of all different types of substances, vaping tools. Like it has not real, like heroin and all these other pills and all these things. And there was a little kid that came up to the drug board, and he was able to tell us what was on the drug board. And I was like, you know what that is? Yeah, I know what that is. So they do know a lot. We have to make sure that we have the resources to support these young people when they need these services. Doing the education, in the schools and in the libraries, it's all very helpful. We've got to make sure that we can support parents as well, because sometimes parents don't even know what they're supposed to do, with this. I'm quite sure if that child's parent was there, hearing him tell us all these different drugs and what they were, that person would probably have been shocked. And so we have to make sure that we have those resources in place. Teaching our youth how to cope with tough situations is important. So some of the prevention pieces have to align with helping them deal with some of their anxiety, dealing with some of their stress, dealing with some of the things that they see in their homes when they do have a parent that has substance use disorder. Because you don't want them to just become so numb to this that they think that this is the norm, that this is how I cope and this is how I'm supposed to deal with my issues by either using alcohol or using some other substance of choice. So we have to up the ante. We can definitely do more with prevention for youth.
And it gets back to the bigger picture that we heard earlier, mental health. So it isn't just don't do drugs, guys, it's dangerous. It's dealing with some of those underlying issues, and that's the sticky wicket, which yes. I think the British say. So I want to read an email that we got from a listener just yesterday, a heartbreaking email. This is from Beth in Hollis. My 22-year-old daughter, Tabitha, passed away on November 15th at a sober living house in Nashua. She was in treatment at the Process Recovery Center in Hudson. The police believe it was due to a shipment of fentanyl from Lawrence, Mass. She was a college student at Chapman University studying creative producing and creative writing. She was 42 days clean. My older daughter and my friends will be at the event, and Beth is here too. I met her earlier. Beth says, I think it will be difficult for us, but I would like to educate myself. And Beth and I talked before the show got started, and I told her that we all were just stunned and saddened and shocked by your daughter's death, and we're so, so sorry. We really appreciate you writing and coming tonight, Beth. And there's a couple questions that come up for me from this story, and Jess, I'll turn to you first. First of all, what do you pull out of this very, very sad story? What hits you when I read that email?
Well, it's very unfortunate to hear that, and you know, we never ever want anything like that to happen in our agencies here in Nashua.
She was at a sober house.
Yeah.
And it makes me think, how did fentanyl get into a sober house? I mean, if I had a child who was in a sober house, I would think, okay, I can breathe for a second.
Yeah. And, you know, I would like to say that, you know, I didn't ever sneak drugs into a rehab facility myself, but on many occasions I did. And, you know, there are ways to get them in there. As providers, we do our very best, you know, to make sure that everyone in our centers and in our organizations are safe, and we take all the steps that we can to ensure that. But unfortunately, sometimes these things happen, and, you know, I'm very sorry for this situation, and, you know, I would open our doors at Revive to welcome you, and we can speak more to that at another time.
Well, and you weren't there, so I'm not putting you on the spot for sure. But sober houses have come under some scrutiny. Some in the treatment and recovery field have sort of called out the state, saying, I'm looking at you, Mel, the state doesn't do enough to make sure that these places are what they say they are, that there's enough oversight. I just wonder if you have any thoughts or experience with that.
I do have experience with it. First, very sorry for your loss. No one should have to experience such a thing. Recently, New Hampshire has started really regulating sober living. Right now, they're regulating to the point of anyone who's going to receive any state funds has to follow certain regulations. But we really need further oversight. And when you look over into Florida and into California, and you see these for-profit sober living facilities, treatment programs, who are making millions of dollars off an addiction and mental illness, it really hits home to what are we doing here in New Hampshire to prevent that from happening. We have some amazing for-profit recovery and treatment programs around here, such as Gatehouse. But what can we do as residents, legislators, to make sure that these sober living homes are staffed appropriately, people are trained appropriately? What's being done for searches? And that's not the complete solution to any of these issues. Even at Mobile Crisis, we'll have people who come directly from the fire department. We search them, and we still they end up getting drugs into our respite. Regulation, oversight of unregulated parts of the healthcare industry is really what's needed in this state to try to prevent things like this from happening in the future.
Well, and Chief, Beth's story also reminds me of what you all said earlier, that a lot of the deaths are due to fentanyl because it is so deadly. And again, it just makes you wonder how the fentanyl is getting into our communities and how people are still getting access to it.
I don't know if someone alluded to it earlier, read the book Dreamland. That tells you how it gets here. I had a presentation from DEA Special Agent John Delina, who is in charge of New Hampshire. He came to one of our Safe Station meetings. And it is just so plentiful. And when we say it's laboratory made, that's a fallacy. It's made in garages, it's made in basements, it's made in storage lockers. And the thing that was so telling, I don't know if anybody remembers the slides on the panel that he showed, where they showed a house, and I'll tell you, he said it was in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and they actually had blenders set up in the kitchen, and they actually had Narcan hanging on the wall for someone to come in if someone got overcome by the fentanyl because there was so much of it, but they were cutting it, so they were using straight fentanyl and then they were cutting it with a cutting agent. And so they did a little experiment, and they put two powdered substances in a blender, and they mixed it up. And then they started scooping it out on a white piece of paper. And one came out, and it was 95% fentanyl. And then another scoop came out, and it was 70%. And then another scoop came out, and it was 30%. And this is where the problem happens, where when people don't know what they're getting, is they don't know what they're mixing. It's not scientific. So you could be that unfortunate person and have that dose of fentanyl that you have normally been using, and this be 95% pure, or the one you used before, it was 30%.
Well, and it gets to what I think Jess talked about earlier. You know, I'm listening to you talking, I'm thinking 95% fentanyl or 70%. I mean, it's so dangerous. And again, those who aren't in the throes of these struggles, I'm going to look at you for this, Bobby. You know, probably listening or saying, how could anybody be so dumb to take that? I mean, we all know what fentanyl is.
Yeah, and it goes back to what Jess said.
You know, sometimes when people hear that someone overdose with using, you know, something that came from someplace, the thing is that it's going to be a good high. How do I
and
get that?
It won't
that?
Be me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So again, it's not this thing of, you know, I'm going to use because I'm going to overdose. That's not what's going on in the mind. And you got to remember, though, there's all these brain changes that have happened, you know, with that rational reasoning, it's not there. And so, you know, again, we have to think about what's happening with an individual who has substance use disorder and has gotten to the point where their brain is addicted to the substance that they need to have it. Any rationalization of that could kill you, it's just not there.
That's the disease part that you've
been
talking
about. That is the disease
part,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Chief, I can see you want to jump back in, and then we will go back to our audience.
So to reinforce what Jess and Bobby said, when people come to a fire station, we do an intake. And we take all kinds of information. And part of that information is, what is your substance of choice you're using? And a lot of people say heroin. And our people will say, do you realize that isn't heroin? And they say, yeah, we know.
Do you want to jump back in, Jess?
Sure. Lisa and I were actually talking about it the other day, and I think it's like 94% of what is thought to be heroin is fentanyl. And you have to, thinking back to my using days, the half-life on it is much shorter. So you're using it more frequently. You're getting a higher high, but it's gone, so you're using it more. You need to use more. And you're building up that tolerance on a regular basis. So when you hear that, oh, someone went out on this stuff, I want that because I'm using it so frequently now that I'm not getting high anymore. So if I hear someone went out, then, you know, there's a chance I could get higher on that.
When you say went out, you mean overdosed?
Overdosed, or sometimes, you know, people kind of just slip out and come back quicker.
Yeah. Getting again to those brain changes that Bobby keeps reminding us about. Let's go back to our audience, and Allie has the microphone. So Allie will come and find you, and if you could just give us your name and where you're from, we'd love to hear from you.
I'm Lata Manjipuri, one of the state legislators from Nashua. Nashua is doing a lot of things in a collaborative way. I do agree. I can pull out just a few that bills that, you know, domestic violence, the effect of domestic violence on our children, requiring healthcare providers to provide opioids. And then also we are inundated with, which is good, regulating sober living facilities. There's so much work to do. Just want to shift our gear just a tad bit to the providers. We hear the chief talking about, we are human too. Talk about our prison, first responders, teachers, public health workers. We burn out.
What are we doing?
That is a great question, Representative.
What are we doing?
Yeah, and in fact, Mel and I were talking about this before the show began, so I'm really glad you raised that question. We were talking about sort of the workforce shortages, Mel, but I also asked you before we went up tonight, you know, how do you keep smiling? How do you keep going? Because it is really hard.
Thank you
for raising the burnout issue.
It's really hard to turn it off. I've also been an emergency room social worker. I've seen people die unexpectedly from overdoses, heart attacks. I can't ever compare to what fire and EMS and police do. But I can tell you, at Harbor Homes, we practice self-care. We talk to each other. We use our colleagues for support and supervision. We talk in supervision about what's going on, difficult cases. We've had a number of cases come through where a patient ended up passing away after coming through the Safe Station program. And what we do is called a critical case review, where we bring the case out, we bring the providers in that were a part of it, and we talk about it. What could have been done differently? How did we get here? And how are the providers who offered and provided that care, from the social worker to the medical doctor to the CRSW who worked on the case? And what do we need to do as a team to heal? Do we need to do an employee assistance consultation? Do we need to get in touch with someone to do a compassion fatigue training? We need to talk about it, and we need to be aware of it.
How do you do all that very important work, you know, just helping the staff sort of cope and heal, but also doing the work, you know, out in your mobile crisis unit, driving around, trying to rescue
people? We have to make time, and that's the key component of the work that all of healthcare providers do and EMS. There doesn't seem like there's enough time in the day because we're back-to-back-to-back with a crisis. But we have to find time where there's a supervision scheduled, where there's a group supervision, and we have to talk about the difficult subjects. Last month, I got a list of suicide letters that adolescents left in the state of New Hampshire, and we talked about that at Mobile Crisis with our staff so we can understand what is happening in our community and be aware of it. Because if as soon as we for a second turn and put our head down or not acknowledge something, then we let that crisis overwhelm us. We have to be aware of everything that's going on in the community and be aware of our own emotions. It's called transference and countertransference, so we're not projecting our own compassion fatigue on our client.
Well, lots of questions from our audience, so we'll try to get a few more in tonight. And thank you for being here. Go ahead with your question, please.
Yes, good evening. My name is Bob Meissner. I'm from the Monadnock region, specifically Jaffrey. And I have one question, and then I'm hoping that I have something that might be helpful. The question has to do with metricizing the benefits from prevention and treatment. I remember listening to Rick Van Winkler, who is the Cheshire County superintendent of corrections, and he's a very progressive individual, and it was pretty clear that the cost of not doing something is immense. And I'm wondering, I'll leave this for you to answer, but I'm wondering what that is, so that some people who might be reticent to be able to speak up and do something, because they say, oh, there's all this money, $42 million for hub and spoke, you know, nothing else needs to be done. But what are the costs? What are the collateral damage, as it were? And the second observation is about grassroots. We've talked a lot about institutionalized efforts, the panelists for sure, and what the state and Nashua Wonderful is doing. But on the grassroots level, I'm wondering if something that the Monadnock Rotary Club is considering doing, which is an awareness, a prevention and awareness run or walk between two Monadnock communities to bring the communities together a la collaboration that you're saying and networking, and then bring the providers there to that location where the event, the Saturday event, will take place, so that people, you know, who may know someone who is suffering in pain or in trauma can look at some of these options. Here's my question is, can that grassroots type effort help?
Okay, thank you very much for coming all the way from Jaffrey, so we appreciate that. Bobby, do you want to jump in on a couple of the points that he made?
Yeah, there's millions and millions and millions of dollars lost when we do nothing. You've got a workforce that's lost. when individuals have substance use disorder and cannot go to work. You've got millions of dollars lost in health care costs and in treatment for individuals that suffer from other damages that are resulting from an overdose when they recover. You've got millions of dollars lost in caring for other diseases that result from substance use disorder. So we're talking $42 million to help mitigate or stop and prevent that loss of productivity from, you know, individuals and from families, because as it has already been said, one person that's dealing with substance use disorder impacts a whole family. So there's, yeah, so there are people that may end up not being able to go to work because they have to care for, you know, a loved one, or, you know, taking in the care of grandchildren or children. Grassroots efforts, response, and any of this are optimal. And in fact, when we think about how the mayor mobilized us here in Nashua, that was done when there was no money initially. And, you know, the community came together and we educated ourselves on substance use disorder, relying on our partners and relying on our stakeholders, providers, to help us understand and learn what substance use disorder was and how it was impacting our brain. When the mayor convened that first group of stakeholders and the mayor's opioid task force was formed, initially, that's what we did. We talked a lot and learned a lot from each other, and that was all grassroots. We had individuals that came to the table that were actively using and in recovery that helped us understand what they were going through, what some of the resources were that they needed, and what we needed to take a look at. The pivotal point, you know, for us in Nashville with implementing safe stations was the mayor was at the point where, you know what, enough is enough, and we need to do this, and we're going to do this now.
Wow.
Yeah. So it does. I mean, those grassroots efforts and just moving and taking action, you know, are key and important. And the $42 million is helpful for our resources, and if we don't do anything, we're going to lose a lot more millions of dollars.
Go ahead, back to the audience, please. And thank you all for the questions. We really appreciate it.
I'm Ian McDonald, and I seem to be correct in my presumption that most of the people we're talking about treating did not begin their odysseys by starting with prescriptions. Would that be a correct assumption?
So how do people end up becoming addicted in the first place? Is that what you're asking?
Yes. One of the things I know from neuroscience is that magnetic resonance imaging has taught us that mental pain is the same as physical pain. And I would have to say a lot of us just have trouble navigating society. I'm one of those people. I'm an alcoholic who hasn't had a drink in almost 8 years. Thank you. It's a pretty Herculean effort for me just to be here. I actually came here on Monday, and my stomach, my anxiety was so bad that my stomach was killing me. I was really in physical pain by the time I got back across the bridge to go back to Derry. I feel like I have a lot to offer from what I've learned. I have a lot of talents. But I'm an extremely introverted person, and I can't help people unless somebody helps me help people.
Right.
I
want to actually pose your question about prescription drugs, because I'm really glad you asked that question, because we haven't really talked about that yet. We talked about the connection between mental health and addiction. We talked about, you know, young people and prevention, but we haven't really talked about the sort of pain prescription drug connection, and that is something that people often do blame for starting this crisis. So thank you so much, and very courageous to stand up in an audience and
you know, tell us what you told us. So thank you very, very much. We do sometimes hear that the opioid crisis started with a prescription drug crisis, you know, Percocet, oxycodone, and so forth. I'm not sure who to turn to on this, but how true is that? It seems to me that it's bigger than that. But I'm not the experts, and you guys are. Yeah, go ahead, Mel.
I can start it off, and maybe Bobby, you know, can jump in. But I can tell you from the clients that I see that very rarely is it that media image that's projected that someone broke their collarbone at 18 and has been prescribed Percocets for 10 years, and now all of a sudden the doctor stopped prescribing, now they had to turn to drugs. It's what I'm saying is there's a combination of that, no doubt. The pharmaceutical industry has just bombarded the market, and doctors are just over-prescribing.
So that is a big part of it.
Big part of it. But then there's also that core part, and it's probably the population that I serve, lower income to moderate income families and individuals, where it's that secondary, it's a use to numb pain of a trauma, depression, anxiety, and it just picks up. And it might start with benzos, Xanax. It might start with Percocet. It's something to numb that pain. It could be alcohol. But in the same context of the other person who asked from Jaffrey about the grassroots piece, getting providers to come out to any grassroots campaign, especially the providers who've been prescribing Percocet and Oxycontin like it's candy to anyone who walks in the emergency room or their private practice, but now all of a sudden they're asked to get a MAT waiver to prescribe Suboxone, and they're like, oh, I don't do that. But you help cause the problem by prescribing 100 prescriptions of Oxycontin. So educating the providers who are prescribing these medications and now shifting them away from providing the Percocets and painkillers when they're not needed to shifting into prescribing Suboxone or Vivitrol would be extremely helpful in getting them into those grassroots type movements like we've done here in the city with Bobby's team.
Well, and I appreciate what you say about physical pain. That's part of it. And we've talked about mental health and that role. So that's the mental pain. So again, thank you for being here. I did want to ask about alcohol. That's come up a couple times in this question. Also earlier, you know, many people in this line of work say, this isn't really an opioid crisis. It's an addiction crisis. Opioids, alcohol, now we're seeing meth. And so forth. What do you all think about that? Bobby, I'll turn to you, I think, in terms of this focus again on opioids. The chief talked about this too, but we've got other addictions going on here too.
Yeah, we do, and we've had them, you know, for a while, and alcohol is one of our number one substances, you know, that's leading to substance use disorder. And, you know, continues to be. I think what we see with the difference with alcohol is that the deaths aren't immediate. Like if a person takes fentanyl and is that immediate death from overdose. But you see it's a long-term effect that alcohol has on individuals who have that as their substance of choice. I mean, we're seeing a lot of things that are out there right now with the fentanyl, the meth, crack is back. I mean, there's just a whole mix of things that when the police are making their arrests, they're finding lots of things that people are carrying.
So we need to focus on the addiction.
So we need to focus on, substance use disorder as a whole and invest a resource in addressing, again, you know, some of those root causes, going back to understanding what's happening with mental health disorders and how people are trying to self-medicate, and they'll use what substances they can get. So they'll use alcohol for numbing mental pain as well. They'll use prescribed medications if they can get it. For some of our young ones, one of our prevention campaigns is lock it up, because if those medications are in cabinets and those things aren't locked up, that's how sometimes our youth get their hands on it. And it may be something as innocent as they're going to have nice little get-togethers and they drop everything in a bowl and mix it all up, and they have these parties where you just grab a handful and you just, you know, take things. And so locking up prescription medications, you know, helping folks understand the importance of, you know, not using those things altogether is really, you know, where we want to go with some of our prevention efforts. But again, focusing on substance use disorder as a whole, and not just, you know, on opioids.
I think we have time for one more question, because I know we do need to wrap it up at 8 o'clock. So good evening. Thank you for being here. And go ahead, please.
Thank you so much. My name is Matt Conway. I'm a resident here in Nashua, and I've also founded an organization called Recoveredia. I wanted to address a couple of the questions that came out of the crowd about grassroots and also a media campaign or some type of campaign to help spread the message and build more awareness. So we're doing an event in New Hampshire called 10,000 Candles for New Hampshire, and it's a statewide coordinated candlelight vigil that will be accompanied by a campaign that spreads the message that the opposite of addiction, depression, and suicidal ideation is connection, human connection. And I think, as well as suicide, you know. So I guess my question to the group is, what are your thoughts on that message and proliferating that message, and how, going back to human connection, how that can really help us come together as a community and overcome this crisis, because no one's coming to save us, right? We're here together. We have to do this together to help each other.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, Jess.
I think it's a great idea. I know we heard a little bit about it this morning at the Mayor's Opioid Task Force, and you know, I'm super excited to hear about this, and you know, I'd like to speak more with you more about how we can get involved here in Nashua.
Go ahead, Chief. What do you think?
Anything we can do is good. We didn't get here overnight. We're not going to get out of it overnight. But I would be remiss if I did not bring up, it's come up earlier, and thank you, Representative, for making note of, this is a terrible crisis, but we also have a terrible crisis that we are losing more first responders in a year to suicide and addiction than we are to dangers of the profession, and that's scary. And a lot of that has to do with what's happening in our world and what our first responders are seeing on a daily basis. And again, not trying to take anything away from anything, but I think what it points out is, I think we need to do a better job as society to take care of each other, to take care of ourselves, and we can't be so laser focused on hot button items, because we as Americans, I think, unfortunately, we are very quick to forget. Something happens, it's the hot button for a while, and then something else happens. And we're not going to get out of this crisis if we don't stay vigilant and stay focused, but take a holistic view of the entire process.
Thank you very much for raising that point. And I did promise to wrap it up at 8, but I did want to ask you all one last quick question. So you ready? Mel, I'll start with you. If the exchange came back to Nashua in a year, what do you hope we would find here in terms of this issue?
I would hope that you would find here a further integrated community team working together for not just the residents of Nashua, but the greater Nashua region. And that we've seen not just an impact that we've had with the Safe Station programs, but a impact throughout the state that has reduced opioid deaths and overdoses. And as the chief said, opened up our scope beyond just this one disorder and really focused on the social issues throughout the addiction. Homelessness, housing, affordable housing, all part.
Mental health, many people have said.
The whole healthcare component, where we really, I'm hoping that we come back, he would come back to see a state that's much more integrated and mimic what Mayor Don just has done here in the city of Nashua.
Go ahead, Chief Rhodes.
I hope we just keep moving the needle in the positive direction. I don't know if there's really one goal we can put out there in a year. I think as long as we can keep staying positive and keep breaking down silos and moving that needle in the positive direction, that's a win.
What do you think?
So I'm going to say, Laura, when you come back next year, that what you will hear are many stories of recovery. Because that's what gives us the hope and the motivation to continue doing the work that we're doing, so that when you come back, that's what you're going to have, more stories, and you're going to have folks here on this panel, and they're going to talk about their recovery stories.
And Jess, your recovery story. So
yeah, I would hope that there's a lot more like mine. I hope that you know, we have a system that's expanded and integrated, as everyone else has said. I would like to see a reduced strain on our first responders, and I would like to hope for like a reducing crime rates, maybe, and a greater understanding that recovery is possible, and we are all humans.
Well, that is all the time we have, and I really want to thank everyone for turning out tonight. Thank you again to the Nashua Public Library, to our fabulous panel. Thank you so much for being here. And to you, our audience, this is The Exchange on NHPR.